Welcome back to Listening to the Dead, Season 2. More crimes, more forensics, more revelations. This is Episode 3, Gunshot Wound.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Listening to the Dead. I'm John Watt, and as always, I'm joined by the only layperson invited to be a member of the Forensic Science Society, Linda LaPlante, together with former CSI in the Met Police, Kath Sutherland, and our special guest this week to discuss gunshot wounds is David Pryor, former senior forensic scientist specialising in firearms and wound ballistics, an expert who has worked on some of the most infamous gun murders of the last 30 years. So welcome all. This is kind of like a reunion show, really, because you all know each other, having worked together in previous lives. Linda, Kaz, I think you worked with David on one of the early TV series of was it Trial and Retribution?
Yes, Trial and Retribution, yeah. You know, I'd written this scene where actually Cass was portraying a villain in a drug den, and he got shot. And the most important thing for me was that when Cass was shot and the blood sprayed, there was a very fine arc of where somebody had been standing behind him. So you knew that there was a person behind Cass as he fell after the gunshot wound and sprayed the wall, and whoever it was had to be over 6 feet. So it was a really very, very important clue for the plot. I get on the set, ready for Cass to be shot. And what colour has the wall behind him been painted? Bright red. I could not believe it. And I said, who has done this? Who painted this bright red? This is the blood splattering. There was nothing we could do. We just had to go ahead, and you had to squint to be able to see the outline.
Just like when Linda said about the part that I played where I got shot, originally when I read the script, it said that it was an ex-detective who'd been dismissed from the force because he was involved with drug dealers. And I said, who's playing that part? And she went, you are. I never volunteered for it. And I said, well, shouldn't I say something? And they went, no, you don't need to say anything. just get shot, throw yourself backwards onto the mats, and then we'll get the stunt man to do the falling over the table. The next thing is, this guy walked in who was my height, my build, and even had the little ball patch, and he was the stunt man.
And that's another point that, you know, the almost universal depiction of a gunshot victim flying across the room. Yeah, which never happens. No, laws of physics don't allow it. So if ever I see that on a film or, you know, whatever, don't do this to me. Look at Linda, get it right.
I'm intrigued, David. How did you get involved with this TV show in the first place?
I can't remember the actual specifics of the original request, but other than would I be willing to go down to the studio to watch the filming of this, the relevant scene that involved a handgun and obviously a shooting. The gun involved was a 9mm pistol, a Luger, First World War German service pistol. And when it came to the actual shooting scene, the gun was raised to the firing position, and I immediately noticed that the safety catch was on. So obviously told the crew that it wouldn't work like that.
Well, I mean, clearly you have to know an awful lot about guns in your role, David. And I suppose I'm intrigued. Where did that come from? Did you have an interest in guns before you started in the role, or was it part of the training?
I did to some extent. Yes, I joined the laboratory in 1970 and did 2 years specializing in what was then called criminalistics, but basic contact trace chemistry, a bit of geology and whatever. In my 2 years in chemistry, I developed an expertise for pattern recognition, which is one of the great skills that the firearms examiner uses in the laboratory to identify bullets, cartridge cases to a particular weapon by the signature that they leave in the way of rifling and extractor, ejector, firing pin marks, that sort of thing.
Yes, that's so interesting. And we'll certainly get to that later in the pod. But if we go back to the beginning of your career, and indeed, Kaz, the beginning of your career, how prevalent were guns in our society? How often did you find them being used by criminals?
I mean, back in the mid-1970s, then it was predominantly guns were used in armed robberies. And sometimes not actually even loaded. And I remember the first case I ever got involved, I was out with a colleague. I was a 21-year-old and a trainee detective on a crime squad. And we'd just gone past Hackney Town Hall when a call came out saying that there was an armed robbery in progress on a security van delivering wages to the town hall. And we'd literally, gone past. We turned round. Luckily, they'd gone when we got there, but there was one of the security guards lying on the floor who we thought had been shot. But it was a shotgun, and it had been loaded. There was wadding in it, and it was the wadding that had hit him in the stomach. And he actually thought that he was dying, but that it had hit him with real force and bruised his stomach badly. But he survived. But Dave, I think that there were some old style villains in those days who didn't believe in using actual loaded firearms.
You're absolutely right. Yes, I remember those heady days of the 70s, the bank robberies, building society jobs, cash in transit robberies. And it was rare, certainly in those early days, for the guns to be discharged. They were taken along, as you say, as frighteners. Then it's typified by the example you've just mentioned, but perhaps a shot fired with just a blank cartridge or discharged into the ceiling of a bank as a frightener. Only very much later on did they become a weapon of actual assault and murder.
When do you think that the shotguns were replaced with the dangerous handguns?
I think, Linda, the shotgun was never totally replaced, but certainly in the course of my career, I did notice, and Cass will echo this, we saw a change in in the modes of armed criminality. Those professional robbers that we knew and loved in the 70s, life became difficult and dangerous for them because of the increased sophistication of armed police units, highly trained armed police, and they were putting themselves in great danger of being on the receiving end of police firearms. And so a lot of the old-style robbers, they moved away into drug crime. It's a lot safer. Monetarily, and the much more money, and obviously much less risky for them in terms of encountering armed police. And then, as time went by, and certainly in the latter several years of my service, the rise of drug related firearms crime, the gang wars in London particularly, saw the increasing, the change from two shotguns and perhaps a handgun to the occasional shotgun and handguns. The handgun was the prevalent one.
I remember as well, Dave, you're right, in the sort of late 90s, the drug war culture and the use of firearms was I mean, it really was getting out of hand. I mean, I remember incidents where, you know, nightclubs, they drive by with a semi-automatic and fire at people. And I had an incident once where a car, one rival gang drove past, sprayed the car with a semi-automatic. The driver ducked. Unfortunately, the passenger didn't. But the driver thought, right, and he just put his foot down, drove to Clapham Police Station, jumped out the car, went in, jumped over the front counter and said, help me.
Yes, yes.
The poor old station officer didn't know what was going on. And it was just, and it became more and more common. And they actually set up what was called Operation Trident.
I've got the lapel badge. And obviously, in the laboratory, we began to work up good intelligence, which later developed into the National Ballistics Intelligence Service, where we could identify patterns of gun crime, where say, as you've just said, Cass, a drive-by shooting happens one day, and a load of bullets and cartridge cases are recovered. A few days later, another one. Then those guns are used again and again, and you start to build up a pattern of who's where. You know, really a pattern identifying a life surrounding firearms and intelligence. You know, based on matching bullets and cartridge cases, what was of tremendous value to the investigating officer.
David, is that now really, when one sees all the true crime programs from America, you know, they're always looking for the cartridges that have been left. And, you know, the shooters have become very aware of how they can be identified and matched. Yeah. And so over and over again, they're looking for cartridges, but the killers or the bank robbers are very adept at removing the cartridges. They take them back with them.
You're absolutely right, Linda. And I well remember a memorable case to me, which was a shooting at Nando's in Shepherd's Bush, where the bad guys did just that. It was across the surfery shooting and indeed death, and they came back to try and pick up all their empties. Fortunately, they didn't manage to find everything, but we identified two or maybe three different handguns used in that.
David, can we dig a little deeper into that? Let's take that Nando's incident then. When are you called to a scene after a murder involving guns?
Well, I think it's not automatic that we go to every shooting. We can't do that. Obviously, there's a limited resource there in terms of scene trained personnel. But Cass is as a laboratory liaison officer, or the crime scene manager, he and his team of scene of crime specialists will attend the scene. If it's straightforward, very simple, maybe just a weapon recovery, then the crime scene guys can do a wonderful job, and then there's no real necessity for us to be there. However, if there's multiple gunshots used, particularly if there's a body in situ and the scene is potentially developing into a complex scene, then we would hope that the crime scene manager would at least come give us a phone call and talk over what they've got there. And ask us if we think we can be of any assistance. And of course, the majority of scenes that where we are called out, yes, we can be of immediate help.
Cass, what do you? I mean, that sounds like a difficult call to make, Cass. I mean, like, you're there, the crime scene manager. You've got to decide whether this is worth calling somebody out an expert out takes more time, things like that. And I presume there's a resource issue as well. What's going through your head in making that call?
Like Dave said, it depends on what you've got, really. I mean, if it was an outside shooting and it's on CCTV, things like that, maybe not so much, but always, if it was inside a house, for example, again, if it was a drugs war, two guys had been tied up with electric cable from the TV plug and things like that, and they'd had Sainsbury's, plastic bags put over their heads, and then they were shot, they were both shot in the head. So for something like that, obviously I would want a firearms expert there to have a look at that.
David, can I ask you how long after a gun is fired that they can tell by the skin on the hands that they were using the gun? Does it wash off very easily?
Yeah, yes. This is the topic of firearms discharge residue, yes. Sometimes called gunshot residue.
Yes.
If it's not disturbed, it can stay there for an hour, two, maybe three. But as a surface deposit, it's very readily removed simply by rubbing the hands or indeed washing them. So if ever the police recover arrest a suspect for a shooting case, the one thing that they're never allowed to do is go to the loo and wash their hands.
Interesting. Ah, what other evidence are you looking for at the scene? Ballistics evidence.
Obviously, we're looking for bullets and cartridge cases. In the case of a self-loading pistol or indeed an automatic weapon in a job such as Cass described earlier on, cartridge cases will be ejected at the scene. Bullets, obviously, in the victim or in you know, parts of buildings. If the gun used is a revolver, then because of the very nature of the revolver, all we have is a bullet. This is a lead bullet from a revolver, but the cartridge case stays in the gun. So the bad guy would, this is always obviously assuming that the gun isn't recovered at the scene, the cartridge case will be taken away from the scene.
What's the more telling evidence there? Is the bullet more important than the casing, or is the casing more important than the bullet to the police?
Well, both they're complementary, because you know, part of our reason for being at the scene is to identify what type of weapon has been used, to inform the investigating officers as to what they've got to look for. Is it a revolver? Is it a pistol? Is it potentially a submachine gun? And in the drug wars, the small fully automatic submachine gun did become quite prevalent. Do you remember the MAC-10s, Kath?
Yeah.
So weapon type, but particularly the relative position of the gunman and the target, either the victim or the buildings. We're trying to recreate the scene. You know, what actually happened? Where was A? Where was B? All this information, vitally important in the early hours of any police investigation.
When you look at a bullet hole in your victim, in your building, am I right that the size of the bullet hole does not necessarily mean the damage to an internal organ? It can ricochet inside the body or twist, because I know there was a Kalashnikov rifle that they devised the most lethal twisting bullet when it was fired. It just ripped into you and kept on turning.
Yeah, here, Linda, we come on to the topic of wound ballistics itself. And let me just explain what we mean by, you refer there to a twisting bullet.
Yeah.
Well, and let's think for the time being, we'll perhaps come on to modified guns later, but every gun that's manufactured for use has rifling in the barrel, a series of what we call lands and grooves, which describe either a right-hand or a left-handed twist. And the reason for that is that the bullet engages that rifling when it's fired to give it spin. And the reason why it has spin is so that it's stable and travels point first. If we look at the two really common handgun ballistics, such as, I say, we've got a 3.8 revolver here, or a 4.5 self-loading pistol there, but both spinning bullets, but relatively low energy compared to the Kalashnikov cartridge case here. And when they strike a body, they will essentially just make a hole, just make a caliber size hole through tissue. Now we come to the other extreme, which is the military rifle. And here is a rifle bullet. This is a Kalashnikov bullet. It's actually smaller in diameter than these handgun bullets that I've shown you so far. But its velocity is much greater.
Yeah.
It will make a smaller hole, initial hole on entry. But by the very nature of its interaction with the body tissues, the rate of transfer of its kinetic energy is much greater and causes, and the interior, the terminal ballistics of a rifle injury like this, the Kalashnikov or the British Service rifle, for example, the internal damage from such a weapon is totally different from that of a handgun, and so this is where our interaction with the medical profession, particularly the pathologists, becomes so important to try and understand the mechanism of injury.
So, if you don't have a bullet or a casing from the scene, is it still possible to work out the type of bullet that was used from simply the post-mortem and the size of the hole?
Well, you can obviously get some information from the bullet entry site. As I say, the actual hole through the skin will be smaller than the caliber, because as the bullet goes in, it stretches the skin and then that relaxes. The bullet will invariably cause generate what we call an abraded margin, and that will essentially be caliber size. So what we're able to say is that the bullet will not be of smaller caliber than the actual physical hole that we can see. But as I say, measuring the dimensions of the entry wound together with an examination of the wound track and its associated damage through the body, that can give us quite a lot of information as to the weapon type used.
David, may I ask you, in the old days, they used to fire into water, didn't they, to test? What is the new device that they use now for testing firearms and firing a bullet?
Well, in the old days, in my early days in our firearms lab in Holborn, it was in the fifth floor of of a glorified office block in Holborn. I don't know that you were around then, were you, Cass?
No, I don't.
You joined later.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a box full of cotton wool, about coffin size, and just happened to be, it looked like a coffin, but it was full of folded cotton wool, And we use that for bullet recovery. As the bullet fires into it, it winds itself up into a cotton ball, protects itself, and stops within a few feet, and we can easily recover it. The more efficient method, which we adopted when we moved to a new laboratory in 1974, down at Lambeth, we had a water tank there, and this is really sort of the international standard for bullet recovery.
And Linda mentioned the rifling there, that the scratches on the bullet case, and you earlier mentioned them as being essential to every gun. What are they unique to each gun and each make of gun?
Let's first start with what we call the class characteristics. And this is the dimensions of the rifling and indeed the disposition of the components of the breech, the firing pin, the extractor, and the ejector. Six screws with a left-hand twist is a rifling configuration used by Colt. Five grooves with a right-hand twist is Smith & Wesson.
Ah.
So immediately, just with eyeball and a lens, we can give that pretty important information to the investigator. Now we zoom in using our comparison microscopes in the laboratory. We zoom into the rifling mark, into the extractor, into the ejector, firing pin, breech face, whatever, and we can see a unique pattern of what are often called striations. And these are markings unique to a particular weapon.
So, sorry, the ejector you're talking about there is the mechanism used to throw the cartridge clear once the bullet has been fired. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. The extractor, first off, is part of the breech that grabs hold of the cartridge case. It literally snaps over the rim at the back. As the round is discharged, it's pulled backwards out of the chamber, hits the ejector, and is thrown clear. And hopefully that's what Cass and his team and me, whoever, will find at the scene.
Interestingly, actually, on that, with the markings on a bullet, I had a case where a guy was shot in Erith, and he didn't survive this time, but he'd been shot 7 years earlier, and one of the bullets from when he was shot 7 years earlier was still actually up in his shoulder.
I remember that one, Cass. Yeah.
So what we did was we said, well, let's take the one out of his shoulder and have it compared to the other ones that are in him from when he was just killed. And the result came back, it was the same gun.
Yes.
And that actually led us to a guy who had stood trial for the shooting of him 7 years earlier.
Yes,
but it all to do with drugs.
And often the case where that happens, you know, someone is shot and survives, and if the bullet is in the part of the body where it's not going to cause any major problems, you know, the surgeon will leave it there, which is what they did in that case, and the body will surround that bullet with fibrous tissue and preserve it.
Like your coffin full of cotton wool.
Yeah. I remember another one where a pathologist, an old soldier died of natural causes, heart attack, I think, but he did have a post-mortem, and the pathologist found a bullet in his chest. It was actually a 4.55 lead bullet from a Webley service revolver. He'd been shot by it was friendly fire in the First World War. But the bullet was so perfectly preserved in the chest of this old guy. It had been there since the First World War, not caused him any problems whatsoever. It was tightly surrounded by fibrous tissue, and which we carefully dissected out. And had it been a case of bullet and suspect weapon, there was crystal clear, really crisp rifling detail that would have allowed us to identify the gun.
David, may I ask you about a case that has fascinated me for many years, and that's the Jeremy Bamber case.
Oh, yes.
And the reason that I'm asking you this is that ballistically, your expertise, you know, you, as you said earlier, you're not called very often to the site. Your job is in the laboratory, checking the bullets, the weapons, etc. So in the Bamber case, if you actually take the horror that the police were met with, there was the father beaten up in the kitchen.
Yes, yes.
Shot. The mother shot. These were shot numerous times.
They were.
The sister and the mother of the baby twins, the little boys.
Yes, the two boys.
Yeah. All murdered.
Five
the emotional victims. Impact of that, of people coming into that horror, would obviously emotionally impair what should have been an incredibly fast decision, which did not come for many weeks, was that she could not have fired the rifle because her arms were not long enough
yes.
to take the rifle. And then the silencer on it. I mean, I have followed his constant pleas for, you know, the case to be reviewed and became quite obsessed by it
yes.
because of the evidence that is forthcoming. Do you not think if a ballistic expert like yourself had been called to that site immediately, they would have said, wait a minute, she couldn't possibly have fired that rifle into her chin. And where was the silencer?
I think it's an absolutely classic case, Linda, of where the police made a fundamental error there in really listening to what Jeremy had to say. And almost being totally blinkered, as you know, oh, it's murder suicide. Let's wrap this up. The fact that they didn't understand alternative scenarios, not only did the firearms specialist not attend, neither did the pathologist. And it was only later on, Peter Vanessis, another good friend of mine, he did go to the scene, but much later on. And I know the chaps it was then the Home Office Firearms Laboratory at Huntingdon who actually did the job, and you know, that they did say later on, if only we'd gone to the scene, then things might well have been different.
Do you think there could have been a mistake? Do you think it was not Jeremy Bamber? Do you think there was a possibility that he was innocent?
Based on what I know, Linda, I did take part in one of the reviews of the evidence. And certainly I'm satisfied that nobody else was involved.
I mean, another infamous case you worked on was, of course, the case of Jill Dando and shot outside her front door, if I recall. What are your memories of working on that case? Did you attend the scene?
Yes, I did. And then this was a classic case where the crime scene manager phoned me from the scene in Gowan Avenue. This is in April 1999. And he's informing me that the victim had been assaulted at her front door, on the doorstep. She'd been taken to Charing Cross Hospital and declared dead at hospital. But the word that he had received from the hospital that they thought she'd been stabbed. However, when he attended and viewing the doorstep area from the adjacent garden, he saw what appeared to him to be a bullet and a cartridge case lying on the doorstep. So obviously there was immediately a conflict of opinion there, of evidence, and so he promptly got on the phone and said, "Look, Dave, I think I've got what looks like a pistol-sized cartridge case and a distorted bullet. Can someone come down and just have a look for me?" And nobody else wanted to go. We didn't know at the time that it was Jill, but it, you know, that came over on the television in our reception area just as I was leaving with my kit bag down to the scene. It is a pistol size, a 9mm pistol cartridge case and corresponding bullet. We could see an indentation on the lower panel of the front door. So that essentially was my input there and then. I was then asked to go to the mortuary. This I always regarded as a very important one of the most important aspects of any type of murder case is where we're able to interact with the pathologist and jointly try and understand the wound ballistics. Now we're looking at the nature of the wound. How can we say how close the gun was? Where is the entry? Where is the exit? What's the relative position of Jill to her assailant? All this sort of thing.
And you could give all of that information from the evidence you found at the scene, or
clearly, you know, having been to the scene, I knew what type of cartridge we were dealing with, which you know, told me that it was some form of pistol. So I didn't know at that stage, because you know the bullet hadn't been formally recovered and put into the evidence log. It wasn't until we got that back at the laboratory that I could see that it had been fired through an improvised barrel of some kind. It didn't bear that classic rifling that we would get from a manufactured firearm.
So interesting.
Can I just interrupt you and ask you, when you say describe the gun, just explain that again, because it's very interesting. That
yes, that's my opinion, Linda, that it was not a gun that had come off a manufacturer's production line.
Right.
You know, not a Colt or a Smith & Wesson or
or a Luger, anything like that.
It possibly
had been altered by someone. Or could have been what kind of gun? A starting pistol that could have been altered into a dangerous weapon? Something like that?
It could have been any of those, Linda. A converted blank firer, a reactivated DAC, as we called them, a deactivated gun. We never recovered the weapon, obviously, so we never knew, and it's still really...
But you were able to ascertain that they were fired at close quarters.
Yes.
Was it two bullets or one? I can't remember.
Just one. The gun, the entry wound, was typical of an intimate contact. The gun was held in contact with Jill's head to the left side of her head, just above the left ear, and exited the right. Temple and gave up its residual energy when it hit the door and just caused an indentation on the door.
Yeah, you can see why the theory that it was a professional hit came about with that sort of close contact, I imagine. Linda, have you followed this case? I know you've followed a lot of these cases. It was obviously a horribly tragic case. And Barry George was arrested and convicted and then released on retrial at appeal.
That's right.
And now it's still an unsolved case.
Yes, didn't they find or suspect gun residue in a pocket of one of his clothes?
They did indeed, Linda. And there again, salutary lessons were learnt. An overcoat was recovered from his home address. And in due course, when it arrived at the laboratory, our analytical team, our firearms chemists, took samples from the coat, including the pockets, and found a particle of firearms residue in one of the pockets. There was no dispute that it was firearms residue, but the whole question of innocent contamination came up. There were issues regarding exhibit continuity, because it turned out that prior to the receipt of the coat in our laboratory, it had been to another police facility, the exhibit bag opened, the jacket photographed in a photographic studio just down the corridor from where firearms were being examined. So there was an immediate source of potential contamination within that facility. All sorts of major lessons were learnt by all concerned, and it informed the subsequent retrial and the reporting protocol for firearms residue. Rather than reporting, yes, we would report the presence of firearms residue, but importantly stress the significance of just an isolated particle. Another interesting bit of research we did about the blowback of body tissue, blood primarily, into the barrel of a gun when in intimate contact. That's a good example of interaction between the gun specialists and the biologists. We're one part of the big machine. You know, got the Cass and his team out on the plot, the laboratories, specialists in chemistry, body fluids, drugs and tox, whatever. So we're necessarily, in whatever the case demands, you know, we're all coming together to.
I think that's the big thing, Dave. I used to find that, you know, they would say, oh, well, yes, I want this, I want that, I want this, I want that. And if it was somebody who'd been murdered, my view was, well, they're dead. They're not going anywhere. Let's consider all the experts we need. Let's get them here. Let's sit down and talk together and see in which order each expert needs to go in to retrieve the evidence and everything. And if you did it that way, it would all work a lot better. But I don't know how you found it, but one of the major problems for me, I thought, as a detective in the police, was that, I mean, I was lucky in the role that I did. I wanted to learn more about science, but the police are not taught enough about what forensic science is and what it can and cannot do. And until they have a better understanding of how science can help you investigate crime and what does the different conclusions mean, I can't see it ever. I can see mistakes still being made.
Well, perhaps we should prescribe the Listening to the Dead podcast. I mean, what better training tool than that? Sadly, that's all we've got time for in this episode, but another illuminating discussion. David, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your expertise.
Thank you, David. Yes.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Linda and Kaz, thanks as always, and we'll be back next week with episode 4, which will be on strangulation.
It's not something that happens in a few seconds. It takes a long time to actually strangle someone to death, and you're very, very close to their face. I've heard and read often it gives the killer pleasure to actually watch their victims dying.
If you haven't done so already, then please subscribe to the series wherever you're listening now, And if you want to learn more about the show and our guests, then visit Linda's website, lindalaplante.com. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Listening to the Dead is made in collaboration with Bonnier Books UK.
CrimeCon, the world's number one true crime event. Get inside the mind of serial killers and psychopaths. Learn from leading criminologists. Hear from the families and survivors. Meet your favorite true crime podcasters. Immerse yourself in forensic evidence and delve deeper into unsolved crimes. CrimeCon is the ultimate true crime weekend, partnered by Crime and Investigation. I will be there, as will Cass, so come and join us. Quote Bonnier, that is B-O-N-N-I-E-R, to claim a 10% discount. Limited tickets are on sale now. For more information, visit crimecon.co.uk. See you there.